Live from Western Canada, welcome to The Kindling's Muse. Intelligent, imaginative, hospitable explorations of ideas that matter most in contemporary life. And now here's your host, Bill Hogg.
Good evening, everybody. Those of you paying close attention tonight will know that I am not Bill Hogg. My name is Kevin Miller. You may have seen me here before. Our regular host, Bill Hogg, is over in Cape Town at the it's the third Lausanne Congress on World Evangelization. So he'll be back next month. So in the meantime, you're stuck with me. We're honored here tonight to have a special guest with us. Normally at the Kindlings, we talk about people. Tonight, we're going to get a chance to talk to someone, and that is Joel Hang Hartsey. And he's a self-confessed youth group dropout turned know-it-all music critic. And he's working on his doctorate in language and literacy education at UBC. So Joel may use some bad language here tonight, but we're not here to talk about language. We're going to talk about one of his other passions, music. And he's talked all about it in his new book called Sex, Love, and Rock and Roll, My Life on Record. And for the record, that's S-E-C-T-S, not S-E-X. So just for the folks at home. So to help us wax intelligent, imaginative, and above all, hospitable, or our regular, I got a grimace at the word hospitable, our regular Kindlings panelists, Peter Chataway and Dr. Allison Jewell. Allison is a post-feminist scholar who specializes in gender and language use in the classroom. Her groundbreaking book, Shushing the Girls, a study of gender participation in the classroom found that boys, I was surprised by this, that boys talk 9 times more than girls in a teacher-led classroom discussion. Allison is definitely outnumbered on this panel tonight, but I can guarantee you, and you probably know from experience, there's no shushing Allison, so we look forward to her contributions tonight. Over on my right-hand side here is Peter Chataway. He's a film critic, journalist, religion junkie, and also, I have to give you a little bit of a disclaimer on Peter here, is that Peter has endorsed this book. And Peter is billed as a film critic or something like that. So, you know, you can just sort of reference him as whatever you'd like to reference him as, only for tonight. I think that's going to be corrected on a subsequent printing. Anyway, Peter's insights on film and culture, you can find them in all sorts of publications, including Books and Culture, Christianity Today, and the BC Christian News. So, we want to... you know what? I just realized I didn't hit my timer here. All right, then we're going to run long tonight. So I'm going to dive right into the topic here. I want to start by having Joel tell us a little bit about his book. Again, it's called Sex, Love, and Rock and Roll, and he's quickly consulting the back cover copy to find a pithy way of describing it. And Joel, can you tell us a bit about your book, what it's about, and why you decided to write it?
Yeah. Well, according to the back cover, I had the idea to write a book about Christian music about 6 years ago, and I really... Do we have the Canucks here tonight? Or
Monday Night Football.
Okay. I had the idea to write a book about Christian music about 6 years ago, and I was just... I was at a time in my life when I was in my early 20s, and I had just kind of was finished with college. I'd gone to a Christian college, and I was tired of a lot of the kind of cheesy and lame stuff that I kind of felt that I was seeing in the Christian music culture. And I thought, I'm going to write a book that's like that just kind of destroys all the cheesy stuff. And I'm going to talk about how you just need to be authentic, and you know, you shouldn't try to have your Christian version of the secular band, and how you shouldn't get all involved in marketing and money. And I was really very self-righteous about it. And hopefully that's not what this book is. I think as I started thinking about it and as I started writing it, I felt like that wasn't really fair to a lot of people, because it's not... You know, Christian music was something that I fell in love with when I was a teenager, and that's what made me really love pop music. And I just started thinking, you know, why do I want to tell some kid like me, you know, who's 15 years old, why do I want to tell him that he should stop listening to, you know, what do they listen to now? Like Reliant K or whatever the bands are. Like, what, you know, I would just be telling him to not enjoy things that he likes. That's not really fair, right? So I started thinking, well, what can I say? You know, I have all this experience of being a fan of Christian music and then later in my life writing about it and sort of playing it and stuff like that. And in the end, I just thought, I'm just gonna tell like where I've been and where I've come from. And that's what this book is about, really, is it's a very personal account of how I fell in love with Christian rock and roll and how I fell out of love with it and how I found a way to kind of make that okay. And I was telling a friend of mine, you know, it feels really self-indulgent in some ways to see this book and see that the subtitle is My Life on Record. And it's like, wow, I'm 30 years old and I just wrote my memoirs. Like, that's kind of silly, right? but I don't think that's really what it is. And I think what makes me feel a little bit better about that is that, like, it's not a very unique experience that I've had. Like, there are thousands of people who grew up in the same way that I did, who really got invested in Christian rock and roll and loved it. And then later we felt like it was kind of bad and weird and wrong, but we still loved it. And then we loved other music. And, you know, so this book is not only really about me, but it's about kind of like my whole generation of kind of evangelical kids or teenagers or whatever. So that's what it's about.
Well, yeah, I really appreciated the book in that regard. That I'm a little bit older than you, but there's a number of elements of the book that I could identify with in regard to basically that love-hate relationship with contemporary Christian music. And I definitely see you vacillating between that in the book. So it's definitely, I highly recommend the book for anybody who has been involved in that aspect of Christian culture or has children who've been involved in that aspect of Christian culture to help understand, you know, what people are going through as they're relating to the music and sort of coming of age within that world. And that's the thing for me that I felt I really wanted to focus on in the first segment here tonight was the connection between music and identity formation, because I really felt that that seems to be something that's so central to what you're writing about in the book, is how music helped you understand who you are. And so I just want to ask the question to you, why do we look to music to find identity?
Oh, man, that's such a good question. I don't know. I mean, there's a kind of crass commercial answer, which is that, like, you know, music is sort of marketed to teenagers because they're spending their parents' money and, like, they can, right? And so, like, let's just get them really invested in it so they're going to buy a lot of CDs and concert tickets and stuff. And hopefully that's not, like, the real reason. But for me, there's something so intangible and ineffable and wonderful about the fact that we can just make sounds and they mean so much to us, right? Like, a guy can hit a drum and a guy can play a guitar and it can create things that just like resonate deeply within us or the lyrics or whatever. And so I guess for me it was like, yeah, just finding these people who were saying things. It's like giving you permission to kind of be who you want to be in a way. And some people find that in punk rock and some people find it in like the Backstreet Boys or whatever. And some people find it in kind of like Christian rock, which is, I guess, where I found it. And it's just it's just a way of sort of showing you that it's like, it's okay to be who you are, I guess. And that's, I think that's something kids want. Like,
right. Allison, can you give some input on that?
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were saying that, because I really enjoyed the book. I thought it was a very profound personal memoir that had a lot of honesty in it, so it never really felt self-indulgent to me. And I do find that usually that kind of voice quite annoying, but I didn't in this case. And I do like your defense of music as an identity formation force because of it. In one of the essays, I think you do a very good job of suggesting that music is this sort of universal language and it's all of the holy place, regardless of its style or genre or whether it's, you know, labeled as Christian or not. There's something in the heart of all people that connect with it. And I thought that was very moving.
What about you, Peter? I'm not sure about your musical past, but in terms of...
My musical past?
Well, I would say more as a listener than a maker of music, yeah. But just in terms of what sort of influence did music have on you and your own coming of age?
It's funny. Literally 1 week ago, I was at my high school's 25th anniversary celebration, and I bumped into a teacher there, one of my former teachers who I hadn't seen in decades. And the first thing he said about me was, yeah, you were really into Christian music, weren't you? And this is a Christian high school, so that's not so unusual. But the first thing he remembered about me was not that, because I'm a film critic, right? And the first thing he remembered about me was not that I watched a lot of movies. It was that I was into music back then, which I found really interesting because I've bought maybe 5 new albums in the last decade. I've sort of stopped collecting music. And Christian music specifically, I sort of stopped paying attention to in the early 90s. I sort of grew out of it, and there were a few bands that I held on to and followed very closely, but but it's part of that identity thing. You know, in the 80s when I was a teenager and I was forming my faith, forming myself, my faith, my identity, my whatever, there were certain artists who spoke to issues that mattered to me, and I remember there was a point around the age of 14 or 15 where I grew tired of... first of all, you had, like, the safe things. You had, like... I'll show my age here. You had things like Stryper, right? You know, which is, like, the Christian heavy metal.
And you would describe them as safe?
Safe, absolutely safe. You know, my friends at school, and this was a Christian school, my friends at school were listening to Iron Maiden and Motley Crue, but I couldn't go that far. Although when my friends did play me one Iron Maiden song that I really liked because it was all about Alexander the Great, and my friends knew I was a history buff. But anyway, Stryper was the safe alternative because they had the hair, they had the sound, but they were singing about Jesus instead, so that was okay. But I reached a point where I was tired of bands like Stryper because a lot of their songs seemed to revolve around become a Christian, become a Christian, become a Christian. The music was seen as an evangelism tool, and you know, quite frankly, I was a Christian already. I didn't need to be. You didn't have to sell me on it anymore. I was a Christian. I didn't need this anymore. I wanted something meatier. You know, that whole going from the milk to the meat idea. And around that time, I discovered bands like Daniel Amos. And Daniel Amos, I discovered afterwards that I got into Daniel Amos right around the time the lead singer-songwriter had gone through a major crisis of faith and had actually redefined his own approach to how he wrote his music. And so he was singing about some profound, sometimes even mystical things, and I was drawn to that. And so I began listening to that, and I still listen to that band a lot. And then in the early 90s, when I sort of left the Christian high school, Christian Bible school bubble, I just didn't want to be confined to that ghetto anymore, so I started listening to quote-unquote real music. But I didn't want to lose my Christianity, of course. I didn't want to lose touch with that. So as somebody in my 20s, I was drawn to secular artists that were dealing with spiritual themes in a way that seemed compatible with Christianity. So people like Ben Harper and Mike Scott and so forth. And in the case of those two artists, I actually got to interview them because I was working for the student paper. And so there's a lot of that identity stuff there. Yeah.
Well, and it brings up an issue. Like Joel mentioned the word authenticity. I think that for me, that was something that was ultra important as a young person. And so, you know, the bands that I gravitated toward were the ones that were sort of doing their own thing no matter what anybody thought about it. And for some reason, I really needed that as a young person. And I went to a Christian college as an older teenager, I guess, and then was led to these similar sound-alikes and was kind of convinced that I should destroy my secular tape, or I guess back then it was mostly cassette tape collection. That's sad. And and then replace them with these sound-alikes. But it didn't last more than a few months before I realized this was a mistake because, as you say, these people just sort of are manufacturing this kind of evangelism message, and it didn't felt like... When I listened to Metallica, I felt these guys really believe what they were singing, and this was coming like from just their raw life experience. And I listened to, I don't know who it was.
Petra, probably.
No, it wasn't Petra, but some of these heavy bands, and I just went, why are you even singing that way? You know? I feel like this is like a marketing tool.
I love Jesus. And,
yeah. Like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a section in the book where you actually describe a Christian concert where the band stops midway and says, we're just fooling you with the music. We really want to
audio adrenaline. I believe.
Yeah,
it was.
It was really
Let's
upsetting
not drop names,
story.
But yes, yeah.
I don't think a woman could have written this book though.
Why not?
Oh, the very first line, which I yeah like he, the very first line of the whole book is like most men my age who were not very good in PE. I loved records. And I was actually talking to some of my girlfriends about this book and what we're going to talk about tonight. And I thought, yeah, we all agreed that all the guys we either dated, had crushes on, flirted with, didn't take very long before, oh, we're talking about the music. And they're talking about the bands they loved and how the bands really meant something profound for them. And we're all rolling our eyes like, yeah, whatever. That there is something so self-indulgent in that conversation.
Well, but
like,
that's something I wanted to ask you about, because I feel as a guy, I didn't so much identify with the music as much as the artist, because I really felt these guys really stand for something.
And I
was trying to think about women, like females, do they go through that same experience where they're really looking for, in a sense, a role model in music?
Feminist theory would suggest that women's relationship to music is a little different because they have been formed and groomed into the role of fan, so they can go nuts over someone like Justin Bieber because they, you know, that's how they react to music.
It's an opposite sex attraction often, whereas I find guys tend to follow male artists.
And most of the music you refer to in the book is male. I mean, you do mention Amy Grant.
My all-time favorite band is Sixpence None the Richer, just
yeah,
FYI.
That was, you know, that was really interesting in the book. I didn't realize that they were a Christian band. I had to look it up and think, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't notice that.
The greatest one ever.
Yeah, and yeah. So there was, yeah, that's true. There was that reference. But otherwise, it seems like music is such a male industry. They make the music. They criticize the music. They promote the music. They love the music. They tell all their girlfriends about the music.
Yes, that's
we're
certainly true.
We're in danger of being hijacked by a post-feminist agenda.
Well,
here.
No, there's certain. It's the high fidelity stereotype, right? You know,
yeah,
that movie with John Cusack and all the guys in the record shopping. There definitely is that, but I'm not sure what you mean by girls being fans, because when I was a kid, I was listening to a number of female artists, even in the Christian scene, and incidentally, to sort of footnote my identity progression, one of the reasons in the late 80s, early 90s that I began segueing out of Christian music and into the secular was because a lot of my favorite artists were doing the same at the same time. Sam, in the mid-80s, I told somebody that my favorite band was Stryper. Yes, I actually said that at one point. And I said that my favorite female artist was Leslie Phillips, and I said my favorite male artist was Steve Taylor. Well, in the late 80s, early 90s, Steve Taylor started a secular band called Chagall Guevara. Leslie Phillips changed her name to Sam Phillips and went secular. And Stryper in the early 90s, put out an album called Against the Law, which was basically sort of turning its back on the old Bumblebee costume phase of their career.
Okay, and I'm sure that there are women who might have this conversation, but I don't know them.
Okay.
I've
got sisters, and we used to talk about the music quite a bit. And my sister, in fact, one of my sisters works at a radio station today, so she sends me. I've gotten more albums from my sister, who works at the radio station, tossing me, like, you know, sort of the spare discs that they don't have room for in their archives anymore. I've gotten more albums that way than I have actually buying any the last few years.
And I'm sure that's true. I'm sure there are women who really care about the music. There are. I mean, there's Alanis Morissette, who's a great rocker, but I don't think it's the usual experience. At least from the people I asked about when I was talking about the book and asking my girlfriends, they all went, okay, another guy doing the music thing. No offense.
It's true, though. I agree with you. So.
I want to move on just a little bit because I think coming of age, music plays a really key role. But as you get older, I think you really allude to that in the book, Joel, that it, you know, you say that I've not actually bought an honest-to-God physical CD. One that I was really excited about in years. Nobody said to me out loud, man, you've got to hear this for even longer. That you've just turned 30 a couple of weeks ago. You're, you know, in a sense entering a different phase of life and music. You said to me over supper here that this is, in a sense, it may be the end of your music writing career because you're moving into a different career. But what role, how do you see the role of music and your identity changing? And I'd be interested to hear from you guys as well. Just, you obviously still listen to music, but what do you go looking for in music now that you maybe weren't looking for back when you were younger?
Wow, that's a really difficult question. Yeah, I mean, I think now, I mean, at the time, really only the first like half of this book is about sort of being a teenager, but obviously that had a big effect on me. And I think at that time when you're really into rock and roll and you are looking for more of what is cool and what is like exciting and what kind of makes you feel good and stuff. And I feel like what I want now from music is just like, I don't know. I just want kind of like comfort and like solace and like to feel like to feel happy. I don't know. Like before it was kind of all about sort of being cool and posturing, but now like, you know, I have my favorite albums and I just kind of play them like over and over again. Like I don't care as much about like looking for really great new music anymore. Like
Joel is saying he's gotten old. What's happening? Allison, really
quickly.
Oh,
that's what that is. Okay.
Really quickly, but what about you in terms of your relationship with music these days?
Yeah, I would agree with that too, that there's something familiar within the music that I find I want what's familiar, or I'll listen to the oldies. You do a good job of analyzing the oldies in the book too, and that the oldies aren't necessarily old, but the people listening to them are getting older. So therefore, like I can put on a Michael Jackson now and think, oh, I remember when this first came out. I remember when I first heard this song, or, you know.
So it's a way of maybe kind of remembering
there's a nostalgia within it.
For me, I said, I think already that for the past decade or so, I haven't bought any. So I'm 40 now, you're 30. So when I was about the age you are now, I kind of stopped paying attention to whatever the new bands were, and I just haven't paid attention to it, really. Although things do creep in, because now that I'm on Facebook, friends of mine are always posting YouTube clips of music videos, and so I check it out because, oh, why does my friend like this? And so I still come across stuff that way. But in fact, when you say that nobody says to you anymore, man, you got to hear this, well, every now and then somebody, like if I'm at home, my wife will be watching something on her Facebook wall, and she'll say, oh, you got to see this. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Or movie soundtracks, too. When you discuss Good Will Hunting in the book and the soundtrack to Good Will Hunting,
yeah.
I did not know. I mean, I love that movie, but I didn't know the band. And then I looked it up after I read it in your book about the
Elliot Smith.
Yeah. And I wouldn't have known that that's who.
And that's the major thing for me these days is movie soundtracks. So, I mean, I've been collecting movie soundtracks for almost as long as I've been collecting music, almost, because there's not really many movie soundtracks in the Christian market. So it was
I'm going to have to jump in here, guys.
Okay. Is that possible?
Be the master of the timer. We can pick this up again after the break. We're talking with Joel Hang Hartsey and his book, Sex, Love, and Rock and Roll. We'll be back in a few minutes. All right, welcome back, everybody. We're here talking about sex, love, and rock and roll. Thank you very much, Joel. And we're with the author, Joel Hang Hartsey. And before the break, we were talking about the relationship between music and identity. And I want to go on and talk a little bit about an extension of that in terms of music and community. But before I do, I want to mention the forms that are on your tables there. In the third segment of tonight, we're going to take some questions from you, questions for Joel or for our panel about the issues that we've been talking about. So take some time over this session and in the break to fill those out, and we'll come around and collect them. So before the break, we were talking about identity, and I really think that it's difficult to talk about identity without also talking about community. Because I think that music, in the search for identity, it leads us to find community with other people who share our affinities, we share our values, particularly if we're seeking out Christian music and that sort of thing. And I just wanted to, there's a little bit of a lament in the book about the loss of community that it really tells me that Joel is indeed getting old, in that things just aren't the way they used to be. And he says that the experience of buying music doesn't feel anything like it used to. He claims that, I don't know how many thousands of CDs you once owned, but you could almost remember every day that you bought every CD, and it was a moment for him. And that I used to love going to record stores on Tuesdays to find out what was new. The thrill of walking into Sonic Boom Records in Seattle, asking the guy at the desk, what's the best Built to Spill album? And then buying it and trusting that it was going to be good because this guy knew what he was talking about. But when I walked into Vancouver's best-known indie record shop a few weeks ago looking for the new Magnetic Fields album, the clerk said, "Oh yeah, I think it's out now." I knew it was out because I've been reading about its upcoming release on the internet for months, but I was willing to play along. I've been looking forward to the idea of going to a record store to buy a specific record, to strike up a conversation, to rip off the plastic, smell the ink and paper of the liner notes. But instead, "Yeah, I guess we just haven't gotten it in yet or something," he said. What was the point then? Why not just download this album, just like I downloaded the last Magnetic Fields album while I was living in China? It was easier that way. Easier, but a little sadder. It's a sad story.
It is.
About losing something. But, you know, I often think about music that way in terms of a way to find your tribe. What would you say about that, Joel?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that's what a lot of this, I think that's what a lot of this was about, in a way. Like, one thing I mentioned, I think, is like, as a kid in a relatively small town growing up in Spokane, Washington, like, I was, you know, I would go to school and I would go to church, and nobody I knew seemed to like the same kind of stuff that I liked. It was like, at school, everybody was listening to kind of like, whatever, just sort of, I don't even know, what were they listening? I don't know, Smashing Pumpkins, Nirvana, things like that. And I was like, well, I don't really like that. And then I would go to youth group or in church, and they were listening to, like, what was popular then? Like DC Talk or like these very mainstream Christian bands. And I just didn't like that. And I found this, to me, I guess like the Christian rock scene, the kind of underground Christian rock scene was where I found, I think I already said this, but it was just like I found people like me. Like I found people that I could relate to. So I discovered a band like Sixpence None the Richer or bands like The Prayer Chain or Poor Old Lou or these other bands that I'm sure none of you have ever heard of because you're looking at me like... with blank stares, but it meant a lot to me at the time. But you find that there are these pockets of kind of people like you, in other places, and that you're kind of part of the same thing, and you read the same magazines, and you buy the same albums, and you like, it's like a what they call an imagined community, right? It's like it's out there. You might not see it. But it's there.
But the internet, you say in the book, has ruined that for you.
Yeah, you said I said that, but I don't know if I really meant it.
I don't have the page number, but it's in there, folks.
Well, maybe it ruined it in the sense of, like, the internet has just become this thing where, like, everybody's just kind of acquiring things and kind of just being mean to each other. And, like, I don't know. I see the internet as, a pretty inhospitable place, I guess. And now that all music has kind of moved onto there, like...
Don't you also say that you can... hear a song somewhere and think this is kind of groovy and then look for it on the web and then listen to it once, even if fully that, and then you'll never actually need to connect with it again, as where if you buy it, you have it in a sort of visceral, you have it in a visceral way, an actual way, and you're feeling it in a different...
Well, and you had to go to a human being in order to acquire that music.
Well, and that's, as I said in the book, like, there's this kind of odd and very disturbing resonance between, like, the proliferation of music online and the proliferation of pornography online. Like, I hate to say that, but it's, like, it's this sort of cheap, ugly, disposable thing that you can kind of search for and find, and, you know, and...
Really?
That's
you would equate music with pornography today?
Yeah, you do say that in the book.
I did say that in the book. I didn't mean for it to be like that, but, you know, there are some kind of weird, disturbing... similarities, I think.
Because it wasn't thorough, because there wasn't a deep experience with the person and the band.
So you're basically being promiscuous with music.
Yeah.
You're not actually forming a relationship and having... Okay, that's
exactly.
Interesting. Peter, what do you think about that?
This isn't quite the same thing, not quite, because my own experience with music, I mean, the secular, quote-unquote, real music I got into was largely... A lot of it, I hate to say, was through Columbia House. But the Christian music, even, I... there were a few stores I did go to, but I honestly don't remember having terribly personal relationships with the people there. Partly because you don't really find a whole lot of Christian music stores. What you find is Christian bookstores that have a music section. But the people who run these bookstores, a lot of the times it's like some middle-aged couple who like put the music there because they know the
concerts.
Kids are into it, but they don't care about
the
music.
You go to the concerts.
You do, but no, but these bookstores, right? They hire the cool guy for the music section. That I used to shop at this. Place called the Coffer Gift Company. They'd been around for 100 years. It was a Catholic bookstore. But they hired a cool evangelical guy with earrings and tattoos to run their music section. So I would always go to him and find out. Like,
But as far as the notion
Not a woman, by the way.
Of course. No, actually, there was a woman, although I think she was a lesbian, but there was a woman. Yeah.
There's always that.
As far as the notion, though, that when you invest in something... when you restrict your ability to access stuff and you force yourself to engage with it more, this isn't really quite what you were getting at, but I think it's analogous. I used to have a CD player, which I first got. I got my first CD player in 1988, and then in 1992, I moved somewhere, and I decided to sell the CD player to somebody else because I got a brand new 5-disc CD changer, which I thought would be the coolest thing. I could load up 5 CDs, and then I could, like, that would be even better. I don't know why I thought it was better. But what I found after I upgraded, so-called, to the CD changer, what I found was that before I had hundreds of CDs on my shelves, and whenever I was finished listening to one, I would pop it out, and I would go to my shelf, and I would look at the discs and think, what do I want to listen to now? Whereas when I got into the habit of putting 5 discs in my changer, I didn't go to the shelf with the other hundreds minus 5. I simply looked at the 5 on the CD changer. Well, I want to listen to what do I want to listen to? Number 1, number 3, number 4, and that was it. And I wasn't as engaged with the selection of whatever I was in the mood for at that moment.
Well, it's like an iPod now, right? It's like I change the music on my iPod like once every couple of months, and it's just like I will literally put it on shuffle, and I will hit the next button until it comes to a song that I want to hear. Like, that's how lazy I am about it.
Would it be fair to say that your book is kind of a testament to the power of the of music as a backdrop to the formative experiences of your life, which is why your teenage years were so critical in aligning with this? But you do go on into college and your relationship with your wife as sort of there's a soundtrack in your
the
own life.
Yeah,
life.
Exactly.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to just sort of bring this a little more focused on Christian music, because you definitely have an ambivalent relationship with Christian music, in the book at least, where you describe at one point evangelical rock music as evangelical identity music, and then later on you say that when the words Christian and music get too close to each other in a sentence, they create all kinds of weird, unpleasant associations. What do you mean by that?
Specifically, I'm referring to the artist known as Carmen. I mean, I didn't mean that there, but I mean, that's to me, when I think of the quintessential, like, most embarrassing thing that Christian music has ever produced, and I hate to say it if anybody is a fan of him, but Carmen is this guy, I don't even know how to describe him. Do we know how to describe him?
He's flamboyant.
He's flamboyant. He's
bombastic.
Like, but here's the thing, like, nobody...
He's a macho Jesus.
I have never heard of him.
Okay, nobody I know...
Must be a guy thing.
I was going to say, it's a guy.
Nobody I have met...
And he's been around since I was in high school.
Yeah, never, I mean, he's like 100 years old, but he looks like he's about 40. And nobody I have met has ever heard of him, but he constantly sells out stadiums, and you don't have to pay for his concerts.
Today?
They're always... Oh, I don't know, probably. They're always free, or there's like a love offer. Anyway, Carmen, so how do we describe him? He's like a... his classic song is this song, Witch's Invitation. Do you know this song?
I would have said his classic
sing
was
it,
The
sing
Champion.
Sing it, Joel, sing
but,
it.
You know.
Okay, maybe that, but no, I can't
well,
sing
the,
it.
Let's not get into...
The Champion was the big one when I was in high school, and then he made a movie.
That's right.
The movie was called Carmen the Champion. It wasn't that Carmen starred in The Champion. I believe the actual title of the movie was Carmen the Champion.
So he's like this, it's kind of spoken word, and has anybody ever heard his music? Okay, great, good. So it's very bizarre.
I see a Carmen t-shirt in the back over there.
It's very theatrical. It's kind of like exciting and interesting, but it's so cheesy. It's just like I can't even put it
into
words.
Is it kind of like Liberace? But
yeah, exactly, like Christian Liberace.
So, but you're saying though, you're
That's helpful, thank you.
You're saying that when... You're basically reacting against Carmen, but in the book you celebrate so many other Christian artists that you enjoy so much. So I guess I'm just trying to find the, you know...
Yeah, where's the line
here? There's a sense of being uncomfortable with it, but maybe I want to throw the question broader out there. How do we even define Christian music? Because I think we're working on an assumption here
it's a marketing term. It's like saying independent music. What does that mean? And you know, I don't really personally like to get into the whole definition question, because really the only utility that I can see for having the term Christian music is for marketing purposes. That you're going to because you're going to sell things in the Christian bookstore, basically, as opposed to letting kids go to regular record stores and buying things there. Because you know, and then you get the crossover artists, and then you know, because I, The first major crossover artist from the contemporary Christian music world over to the secular world would have been Amy Grant. And when Unguarded came out back in 1985, I think it was, I was in high school at the time, and I can remember that, you know, just the anxiety that you that various evangelical high schoolers and others were expressing over this, because now Amy was appearing on like the secular TV shows. She was singing a duet with Peter Cetera, and he wasn't even her husband. And like, and just, I don't know. Just,
I remember
I just,
that.
I just so don't care for that. And the better model of for how to deal with being a Christian in the music sphere was Cliff Richard, who is practically unknown in North America, but my dad's British, and we lived in England for a few months when I was 6 years old. So Cliff Richard was a big pop star in England, and still is. He's had a hit every decade, I think. Well, I think this last decade he missed one, but he had like a number one hit for like five decades running, from the 50s to the 90s. And he became a Christian in the 60s and began putting out Christian records as well as secular records, because he was Christian, but he was also a pop star. So he put out both kinds. And that was it. Nobody cared. And so in England, at least, he was able to do both of these things. And that for me was sort of, and he even wrote Bible studies. When I was 14, I was reading Cliff Richard's Jesus, Me, and You. So devotionals, I should say, not Bible studies. And you know, that to me was the model. Whereas in North America, there was this insistence on a rigid division. And then when somebody tried to cross that division, it became this huge thing to be anxious about.
Well, because it probably made the marketing people most anxious of all. It's like, how are we going to package this now?
Yeah.
Right? We had this all sewn up. I mean, and I think that brings up an interesting point for me is, you know, you talk about CCM, contemporary Christian music, and how it can make us lazy. Because if you're a fan of Christian music, you can just slide by without ever really paying attention to what you're putting into your head. So, in other words, if it's been stamped with the mark of approval, it doesn't matter how hedonistic it is. It's part of the CCM world, so it must be okay. But I think what you bring up, Peter, is the whole idea of Christian as a market category. And to me, you know, one of my favorite characters in recent films is Frank Costello, played by Jack Nicholson in the movie The Departed. And the first lines out of his mouth in the movie are, "I don't want to be a product of my environment. I want my environment to be a product of me." I love that line. And I think that when it comes to, you know, the whole notion of Christian music, to me it seems like the ultimate triumph of consumerism over Christianity. It has basically subsumed Christianity into nothing but a market category or a target audience.
You know what's interesting is that in the early 90s, I believe it was around the early 90s, a lot of the Christian labels, or maybe even in the 80s, a lot of the Christian labels were being bought up by secular companies. And there was a lot of anxiety around that at first, because they were saying, oh no, the secular companies are going to want us to water down the message. But what you started hearing, and I don't know if this is still the case, but what you started hearing was that actually the secular companies were telling their Christian labels to pump up the references to Jesus, because they knew this was what sold to the Christian market. So if you were a Christian artist and trying to explore your faith in a genuine artistic manner, you had the record company coming at you and saying, no, make it more Christian, make it more identifiably Christian, because that'll sell.
Some of the bands that Joel mentions in the book, though, that are Christian bands, that you particularly like, Joel, had something else to say other than become a Christian and do it like this, right? Some of them were, I think you call them, not grapplers, grapplers?
Yeah, although that's Greg Wolf's term, not mine, but yeah.
That you found the bands that were really trying to figure out how you can have faith in amongst your actual real human experiences much more intriguing as bands. I was really intrigued with the part of the book where you discuss the music inside churches during the worship team and the role of drums or no drums or where are the drums and how often do you sing the chorus?
Or how about the yawning gulf between the lyrics of the song and then...
Oh, yeah, the dance. Wasn't it the dance?
I feel like dancing. Yeah. Have you ever sung that?
And no one's actually dancing. Yeah.
Yeah. What's that song? I can't remember what the name of the song is.
I Can Sing of Your Love Forever.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And, yeah, no, I think that's interesting. Because the whole worship music thing is, to me, almost another...
Well, and that's weird, too, because on the one hand, like, there is something very... on the one hand, it's kind of unassailable. Like, if it helps people to get close to God, like, that's great. But on the other hand, like, it also has become a marketing category. That's almost even more heinous than Christian being a marketing category. Like, worship?
Because it's in church. You're in church.
It's become an industry.
It's awful.
The worship genre.
As we move toward the break, I want to just maybe get a brief comment from each one of you on that in terms of how can we avoid being a product of our environment? Because I think if the one thing that defines North American culture, it's consumerism. Anything that appears on the horizon is immediately packaged and sold, including a pilot who lands a plane on the Hudson River. We can sell anything. So how can we sort of, if we're supposed to be countercultural, how can we counter the culture in that way in terms of music?
That's an interesting question, but the one part of the book that I couldn't, or that I really, maybe really, really liked and found intriguing was the aspect that we were maybe part of the culture in a very humble human way. So that maybe the countercultural quest was its own problem, that there's something very human about loving good rock and roll that I found really intriguing in the book, that it wasn't, you could just love a really good rock ballad, just go for it without having to spiritualize or pretend it's about God when whatever, it wasn't really about God. Or so there was a humility that I thought was quite holy in what the book was, part of what the book was saying. I really appreciated that part.
I guess I would have to echo that, especially because maybe you were saying something that I was saying. So, but no, I agree because, like, to be countercultural was to not say I'm gonna make Christian music or I'm gonna listen to Christian music. It was I'm gonna find what I love and I'm going to do it as well as I can. And that, you know, Dorothy Sayers, right? The only Christian work, the only Christian work is good work done well. And to me, that's what I would aspire to do, whether it's in this book, which is okay. I don't think it's a great book, but they'll edit that part out.
It's a great
book.
It's a great book, Joel.
You can't say that.
They'll edit that out later, right? So whether it's this great book that I wrote or, you know, if I play in a band, like, just do it well and do it with grace and humility and love and passion and, like, That's all I can do, I think so, yeah.
Peter, anything to add?
No, not really, actually. Wow. I mean, you know, we're all products of our environment, but we also can affect our environment, but I don't think we can't avoid the fact that the music we buy is music we're buying, you know? We are consuming the music we get. No matter how mass market or independent or obscure it is, we're usually consuming it on some level. But I think we should do it perhaps more consciously instead of simply going for whatever we heard was good. And also we should, you know, to echo what Allison and Joel were saying, we should be true to ourselves, be true to what we love, you know, and love it because we love it and not really care if anybody else does.
Can the worship band go behind the screen? Or that was in the book that the
Something we're gonna have to take up in the next segment.
So
we're gonna have a
chance
to you know, listen to your questions. You guys can react to this, affirm this, you know, take any sort of position you want when we come back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Kindlings. We're in the third segment of the night where the audience gets a chance to fire some questions and make some comments to the panel. So we're going to start with Jeremy. Okay, go ahead, Jeremy.
Joel, my question's for you. I know we touched on it a little bit, but when you're talking about Christian rock and roll, are you defining that by simply just singing about Jesus, or can it be defined as Christians in a band playing music that sometimes that involves talking about God and sometimes just life?
Right. Yeah. I would definitely tend to go towards the latter. I think there was a really good book, I think it was in the 90s, and it was two sociologists from the University of Washington. They wrote this book called Apostles of Rock, The Splintered World of Contemporary Christian Music. They identified three types of, like, philosophy about what Christian music is. One was basically for evangelism purposes. One was more like for worship-type purposes or, like, kind of encouraging believers. And one was for more like just general, like, artistic, I think, I forget what he called it, maybe transformational or something. So I would put myself more in that third camp, the more like, if you're a Christian, you just, like, try to do like good things, right? And sometimes you sing a song about God, and sometimes you sing a song about like a girl that you like or a guy that you like or whatever, you know. Like I can't see the division. So I think, and I'm encouraged now that I feel like more young rock bands are doing that same thing. I think that's awesome, because I don't think you should limit, you know, let's not limit human experience. Like, what? How silly would that be? Like, don't we kind of believe that being Christian is like sort of the fullest human experience we can have? So to limit it seems silly. So I would go definitely with the latter. Yeah.
So you want to see a Christian album that's all about sex is what
yes.
you're asking for?
Yes.
All right.
Either with an X or a CTS.
All right. We go now to John.
Thanks. This is a comment more than anything else, but I value music for what it does for my spiritual development and maturity. Much of the contemporary Christian music is hard to sing and listen to, even if the words are meaningful. I like oldies like the Gaithers and so on. So now I've established where I'm at.
Anybody else up there like the oldies?
You know, I just want to toss in a tangential, if that's the right pronunciation, comment about the Gaithers. Actually, it's not about the Gaithers at all. I don't know the Gaithers. They were the grown-up music when I was in high school. But Bill and Gloria have a son named Benji Gaither, who happens to be good friends with a filmmaker named Corey Edwards. And one of the most delightful moments in my life as a Christian film critic, who also sometimes writes for secular publications, and that's been an interesting identity issue, but that's another topic for another day. One of the most delightful moments in my career like that was when I saw a cartoon called Hoodwinked, and as the closing credits were playing, I noticed that the score, the soundtrack for the film, was composed by a guy called John Mark Painter, who I immediately recognized his name because he was with a band with his wife called Fleming and John back in the 90s. And I immediately recognized his name, and I thought, wow, like Fleming and John did the soundtrack. That's awesome. And then I got home, I did some Googling, and this is before the movie had come out. And I did some Googling, and I very quickly discovered that, and I shared this information with some friends of mine purely for the music connection, and then one of my friends said, oh, the director, Corey Edwards, he's a Christian stand-up comedian, and I had no idea. And then I found out after, so then I immediately tracked down the email address for the production company, and I emailed them and said, hey, can I talk to you for the Christian newspapers? And then very quickly, you know, one thing led to another, and I discovered that possibly the best song in the whole movie, sung by a character called Japheth the Goat. Japheth the Goat, the voice is provided by Benji Gaither. And Benji Gaither is a friend of Corey Edwards, and they all made this movie together. And the thing is, this was not a Christian movie. This was a secular movie put out by the Weinstein Company. It was an animated film, and it was actually... it was considered an independent animated film because it wasn't made by Disney or DreamWorks. It was made on a very low budget, and it did surprisingly well for a film of that caliber. And it was a Christian who had made this film, and that was just one of the most awesome discoveries for me in my film reviewing career, to see these Christians who had made this film, and I had no idea. I went into the film, because so many movies these days are now, like the marketing is targeted at Christian audiences. If there's a Christian involved in a movie, they'll make a point of selling it to the audience, whether it's Secretariat or The Blind Side or whatever. They'll make sure that the churches know that there's one of you in this movie somewhere, you know? Hoodwinked was not promoted that way. The Weinstein Company simply didn't bother to plug into this. And just discovering that the movie was out there and Christians had made it as a fun movie, not trying to evangelize, not trying to, get a religious footprint on the, you know, in the Cineplex. They were simply trying to make a good movie that the whole family could enjoy, and with like great music and so on. I thought that was awesome, and so. There's a slight Gaither connection there, but
was John's question kind of more about genre? I mean, is it possible that the Gaither's style was kind of more, I don't know, soft country kind of vibe?
That also worship music as well. I mean,
yeah,
I think it was really a revival of older worship music.
But that's different than hard rock or punk.
Well,
anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a particular style.
But I think also, like, there is this weird blurring. We were talking about Christian music or worship music or what is it, and do you sing it in church? I think now for people of my generation, like, we're kind of saying, well, this like rock worship music, it is kind of hard to sing. It is kind of weird to have a couple hundred people singing like a pop star. Why would we want to do that in church? And there's a great organization right now called Bifrost Arts, which you should check out. And they're doing they're taking sort of contemporary kind of independent rock people and singers and stuff, but they're doing very traditional singable arrangements of either hymns or their own original songs that are just more like normal people can sing them. Like, you know, you don't have to be Coldplay or U2 to sing the songs. And so I think people are hungering for that again.
What's the name of that organization?
They're called Bifrost Arts.
Bifrost Arts.
Yeah,
okay.
Check it out.
We want to move on to Ron. He's got a couple of questions here, one for Allison, one for Joel.
Okay, I'll start with Joel. Your book chronicles your personal journey, and having examined the progression of your own relationship with music and those of others, what can you say about music genres leading us to a message, or the search for a message leading us to a genre?
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. That's such a good question. Well, I can start with the second one. I don't know if I can do the first one. Can you repeat the two distinctions again?
A music genre leading us to a message. So all your friends are listening to Iron Maiden. Where do you end up? Versus searching for a message leading you to a genre.
Right. Oh man, both happen so much. Like, I was just thinking. I mentioned in the book. I think like I liked this Christian punk band when I was a kid called MXPX, and they're really fun and they're really good, and they're from Seattle or whatever. And but because of them, I started listening to like all these other punk bands that I never would have heard of, because I was like, well, MXPX is punk, so it's okay for me to listen to punk because I'm Christian and they're Christian. And so now that means I can listen to The Clash and the Sex Pistols. And it's sort of a weird, like, that's probably not what people would hope, I guess, from that. So on the one hand, there's that, right? It opens up this world, like, hey, check out this cool new music. You're introduced to it in a way that's like Christian, and you can relate to it, and then you learn more, and that's cool. But the other way around, I think the same thing can happen. I guess for me, that happened first, but certainly the other thing can happen. I don't know if others would have something to say on that. I'm not sure if I have a good example of the other one. Yeah, sorry.
I just want to say that the first time I ever watched David Letterman was in the mid-80s because Amy Grant was on the show, and then I kept watching it after that. So, you know, so these Christian artists who are crossing over became my introduction to the real world.
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny.
So you backslid.
Or kind of forward slid, I don't know.
Okay, so question two was for Allison. I always love you on this program. So as a guy who fits your male stereotype with two sons who fit your male stereotype, yes, we're that simple, I wonder, is there a typical female relationship with music, or are you guys just too complex for us?
Ooh.
Well, my small little set of experiences, certainly women like music, and that's obvious too, and it's part of the human experience. So regardless of the gender, I mean, there's a connection with music because it does sort of speak to something very, you know, profound in everyone. I guess I was only reacting to the kind of view that the music is maybe the only way into an emotional conversation, and maybe women and girls who have other kinds of options to discuss their, you know, emotional depth don't go to music as the first point of call, but a lot of the men and young men in my life do seem to start there or even stay there as their emotional type of conversation. So instead of maybe talking about, complexity of relationships or something and how they're really feeling, they'll say, oh, you should listen to this song. Well, you can, okay, yeah, but why don't we just talk about the feelings? Yeah, well, we could talk about the feelings, or you could listen to this song. So it's kind of...
Do you have any music therapists in your family?
When I was thinking about Joel's book in particular, and, like, I don't know, like in high school, and if you were talking to guys about, like, the algebra quiz or something, and, you know, it was a great conversation about algebra or something, and then we're suddenly talking about Fleetwood Mac, and you're like, well... why are we talking about Fleetwood Mac? Well, yeah, but that song, man, like, it really spoke to me. You're like, huh. And it could be that it connects with an emotional depth without not maybe without, but a way to access an emotional conversation that perhaps locates it quicker or in it more, yeah, I don't know.
But it almost sounds like you're suggesting that, that men sort of directly access this emotional level without going through the head, whereas women have to talk about it. Is that what you're saying? It sounds counterintuitive, and maybe I'm just being provocative here, but I
don't even know if have to, but just the tendencies seem to, I mean, I had would have more emotional-based kind of conversations with my girlfriends without talking about music. I have some very, very close girlfriends that I have no idea what their musical taste is at all. Like, I wouldn't even know. If I was in the car going to the mall with them, we wouldn't turn on the radio, we wouldn't talk about it. I have no idea what they listen to, what they find compelling. But the men I know well in my life, I know. I know everything my husband's listening to. I know what my son listens to. They're talking about this movie. I know. They make it very clear very early on in the relationship. This is what they find meaningful, and they remind you of it and whatever. You know, new bands coming out. But I don't have those conversations with the women in my life. And
Joel, you were nodding vigorously there. could you, in the book, you talk about there's a little bit of a contentious relationship between you and your wife in regard to musical taste. Could you maybe talk about that a little bit?
I don't know. She's here, so.
could she talk about that a little bit?
I don't know. It's like, it is true that, like, I think part of the time, and I mention it a lot, and Allison was saying, like, a good friend that I grew up with kind of this whole time, his name is Daniel, and we just, like, every time I talk to him still, I mean, we've been good friends for 25 years, all I ever want to do with him is talk about music. That's all I want to do. Like, I would be happy, like, and we do for hours, and we're just like, that's our friendship. But it's not a superficial friendship. It's like, we're really close friends, but that is how we do it. And so I can really relate to that. And so with my wife, like she likes music, but that's not all she wants to talk about. So, you know, we learn to deal with that.
And in the book, you also say that Sarah got just a little tired of the over-enthusiasm about certain bands. So you would say, this is really cool. And she'd go, yeah, that is kind of cool. But then you would keep saying, yeah, this is really cool. Yeah, but this is really,
this
really,
is
really
so,
cool.
You have
this
to
so
hear
cool.
this
listen,
one song.
Listen to yeah. it again and again. And then Sarah's like, yeah, zoning out, which right. I thought was an interesting... Yeah. description.
I don't know
that.
If it's just male, though. I mean, we all have our obsessions. I don't know. So
definitely.
Yeah, well, just, yeah. Fair enough.
Again, if I can just jump in there with a quick, you know, like, I'm a film critic, and there are certain films I love, and for almost 20 years now, there are three films I've told people, if you want to understand me, you have to see these three films. And to this day, I don't think my wife has seen any of them.
So. You have to at least name the films for us, Peter.
Yeah.
Lawrence
yeah.
of Arabia, The Purple Rose of Cairo, and The Family Way.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I haven't
there
seen
you have it.
I've seen The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Understand Peter Chataway. Everyone will come here with a new understanding next month. we want to go down to Ron.
Before I ask my question or my comment, just want to say I really was moved by Carmen back in the 80s.
Excellent.
And I didn't know he was
Excellent.
Still doing concerts.
Let's go.
I just saw a news article that both saddened me and was kind of compelling, that the number two most downloaded group or artist is now Glee. The TV show Glee is number two, only behind the Beatles. And what does this say about digital downloading as a distribution method, and especially the move back to buying singles rather than albums, and kind of a disconnect perhaps with some of the theme? But yet also, could it also... be a desire to connect with the characters from the show and the music and perhaps becoming less pornographic in that way.
Oh.
And then another part of it is, could it also be a sign of gender equalization? Because Glee is not a guy show. Not at all. And I would say that...
And wasn't the Britney Spears episode
I would probably think the majority of those downloads are coming from young females.
Or gay men, yeah. Boy. Well, so the first part about that's so interesting, like Beatles followed by Glee. That's it's almost kind of the old and the new, right? It's like the Beatles are sort of the archetype of what rock music was for so long, and now that's very interesting because like you're talking about albums and singles, right? And it's like the album was actually kind of a brief period in musical history. Like it was kind of a blip when you think about before albums. Like you could just either you could buy single records, you could buy the sheet music, and albums were kind of a short period. And now we're back to a format where You know, I don't know. I don't know if
it was the Beatles that sort of started the concept album of Sgt. Pepper and all that.
Exactly.
Yeah, if I can just jump back in, singles used to be the way you bought it back in the 60s. Then it went to albums. And yet the connection between media and music is as old as the Monkeys. If anybody remembers
the band.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. But even the Beatles, actually. I mean, you talked about people identifying with Glee because of the characters. The Beatles, of course, it wasn't just their songs. They had these... They had this collective persona, the way they joked with each other during interviews and on stage. And, of course, their third album was a soundtrack to Hard Day's Night, and they made other movies beyond that.
Well, and what are the Beatles but a boy band, really, to be honest?
Well, they started out as just a boy band, sure. But they had these characters and these other things that they were developing as part of the media package, if you will, that fans bought into.
Well, as we look toward the end of this evening, I was trying to think of an appropriate, pithy remark to get from each one of you to close tonight. And I just thought maybe I'd love to hear from each one of you one of your fondest musical memories. Who was the artist? What was the song? What's a moment from your musical past that means a lot to you? Peter, you're looking at me like you're just dying to go first.
No, I'm racking my brain.
Yeah,
trying to
I can go first. I know exactly.
Sure, Allison knows. I'll ponder this.
Thinking grade 9. My brother was maybe grade 12, maybe first year college at the time, and he loved the band Claw 2, a Canadian band. And just because I loved him, I loved the band and the song "Dear Christine." Was the first real song I kind of grabbed to, and I listened to that thing hundreds and hundreds of times, that song. And I think it was because the connection to him and his cool world, and there you go.
That's interesting. I got into the band Kiss for similar reasons when I was about 5 years old.
Wow.
I love it. For me, this is actually something I mentioned in the book, and this is very weird. It's a very obscure band that I don't think anybody really has heard of much. But when I was about 15, I saw a show in a church basement of this rock band called 7 Day Jesus. That was a Christian rock band, and they've gone on now to do they don't exist anymore, and they've gone on to other things. But they had this song. This is going to sound really weird, but they had this song that the song was about forgiveness, but there's this lyric in the song that was like, I'm almost hesitating to say this out loud because it's kind of like controversial, but it was "Rape My Soul" was the lyric. It was like, "You rape my soul," and I was like, "Holy cow!" I'm at a Christian concert in a church, and like they're saying this really intense thing on stage, and I just remember just this intense, just visceral music, just pounding, just beautiful rock and roll, and this guy just screaming this out, and I was just like, wow, like that is rock and roll. Like,
well, and just to contextualize that, they were responding to the rape of a friend of theirs, right? And just how they felt that had impacted them.
Yeah, and so, just that the power of that feeling and those lyrics just blew me away. Yeah.
And Peter,
I don't know if I can isolate it down to any one particular moment, but for some reason the thing that stands out in my memory is the one that I can talk about anyway. It concerns. Lollapalooza 1995, I think it was 95.
I already like this story.
Well, I didn't go to that much of it, but 1995, that was the year I'm pretty sure it was that summer, that was the year I became editor of the student paper at UBC, which is like a major, like it's a campus of 30,000 plus students, and it's like a small town. So And it's a totally secular publication. So here I was sort of fresh out of college and career and sort of trying to sort of fit into a non-Christian environment. And I went to Lollapalooza and I saw Sinead O'Connor, and she began singing a song off of her most recent album. And I had the album and I'd listened to it frequently. The song was called "Thank You for Hearing Me," and somehow I had assumed that the song was directed at like a human being. As she sang the song on the stage, I saw her looking up at the sky, and I realized she was singing to God, "Thank you for hearing me." And the fact that she was doing this at the Thunderbird Stadium during Lollapalooza, you know, in this totally secular environment, it was a moment that stuck with me because it was, you know, here I was still somewhat tentatively getting out of the church ghetto and into the real world, quote unquote, again, and there was this moment of of somebody's thankfulness to God coming through. Sinead O'Connor's of all people. So it was, you know, it's just something that stuck with me.
Well, that's a beautiful image to end on. I just want to thank everyone for coming tonight. Bill will be back next month, and so will some of our panel here tonight. I want to thank Joel for coming out and wish you all the best with the book. And thank you everyone for your questions and comments, and hopefully we'll see you here next time.